So first of all, I just wanted to thank the organizers. So there's only one organizer here, I guess. this week, I don't know if everyone else feels the same way, but this week, a couple of weeks, has been fantastic. Being able to get out of the lab, especially for experimentalists or pseudo-experimentalists like me, getting away from the lab and taking sort of a fresh look at what you're doing is actually kind of important sometimes. So it's been great hanging around people thinking about things in different ways. And so I've also had the fortune of being able to sit here and listen to all these talks over the last couple of weeks and think about how people are thinking about problems and trying to fit the kind of problems that we're interested in and that we're working on in maybe a more broad context. So I prepared this yesterday, so we'll see if that actually works in practice. So this is kind of the usual introductory kind of slide that I like to give as a focus of the laboratory. And I think of this as sort of, at least for early sensory pathways, as kind of the holy grail of trying to understand, you know, we live in some environment that has some properties that are intrinsic to the environment, and yet we have active sensory modalities. So this just shows saccade path across visual scene. So we as organisms are interacting with the scene in some way. And so obviously that has some bearing on the statistics of the environment that actually fall upon the retina. And also in terms of encoding this information in the pathway, there are mechanisms, as several Marcus gave a talk yesterday and several other people mentioned, on mechanisms which seem to alter their behavior in terms of encoding in response to changes in statistical properties of the luminance distribution, for example, that falls upon the retina. So I think the problem is that at any given moment, you can only sort of take one slice of this. And the problem is these things, three things, are so intermingled that that it makes it hard to actually solve the problem just by looking at one piece. So then I started to think, well, this would be my normal introductory slide. Then I started to think a little bit more broadly in terms of the things we've been talking about last couple of weeks. And I think I zoomed out a little bit and wanted to think about, and I think the title of my talk, which, that wasn't me, was it? Okay. The title of my talk, I think it didn't make it into the schedule, which was something about task-dependent coding in sensory pathways. I started thinking, well, you know, we talk a lot about information processing and how information is represented and transmitted, but then maybe a question that I'd like to ask and think about is, you know, different kinds of information are being presumably transmitted through the pathway, and so the same in several sensory pathways, the same circuits have been shown to be responsible for very different kinds of tasks. So, for example, the detection of a stimulus. You know, we as organisms sitting in the environment. It's very important that when something moves in our visual field that we know that is there. But at some level, we also want to know what that is, and that becomes sort of a transmission of fine details or discrimination. And these potentially are distinctly different functions. And so I'm going to try to give the talk that kind of wrapper, although this is probably the first time I've ever wrapped it like this, so we'll see. The other strange thing I'm going to do is talk about two sensory pathways, which I usually don't do in the same talk. So I'm going to talk about work we've done in the visual pathway, and so this just shows the mammalian visual pathway, and I'm going to talk about work in, I think I've got retinal data in the talk from loaned to us from Marcus's group, and then thalamic data that we've taken. And so I'll talk about the detection and transmission of information in that context through this pathway. But then also we've also recently done some work in the rat vibrissa system. So the rats have these extensive whisker arrays on their face that they use to actively palpate the outside world, and it's been shown that this is an exquisite sensory modality. So it's likely that they also are interested in detecting objects and transmitting information, detailed information about textures and surfaces. So I'm going to talk about, you know, hopefully both of those, depending on sort of how far it goes. So I can zoom through these, I can zip through these slides here because I think they've been covered in some detail, but just to in case anyone didn't see some of the talks by Dawei Dong or Pam or Marcus or Mike Berry, this is not a retinal talk. So several people seem very worried that it was yet another retinal talk. But it is a talk somewhat about visual processing and receptive fields and things like that. So, you know, the sort of general notion of a receptive field is that there's some restricted region of visual space in which presentation of light induces a response in a cell somewhere in the pathway. And we've talked a bit about in this last few weeks about the topographical representation of this as you progress through the pathway from the retina to the thalamic nucleus and then projecting to the cortex. More broadly speaking, the receptive field that we talk about is not just the spatial extent, but spatial temporal integration properties. Over what time window is the cell integrating or the pathway integrating? Over what temporal window is spatial window is the pathway integrating? And so, just to reemphasize what was discussed earlier, is that suppose we have a thalamic neuron or even a retinal ganglion cell that has center surround architecture, and we're able to present a white noise stimulus like this, where each individual box in here is independent from all others and has some luminance drawn from Gaussian distribution. As we click along, let's say we look at a pixel in the middle of the receptive field. This is an on-center, off-surround cell, cartoonish, obviously. And we look at the spike train that's elicited by this stimulus, and we correlate the spike train with the luminance profile in that pixel. So we can actually go through the entire spike train like this just by simply looking at the stimulus that precedes a spike and then averaging over all of the spikes. And so this is a spike-triggered average. And so I just want to emphasize, I'm going to be talking first a little bit about transmission of details before I get to the detection problem. And so when you do this and you go through the data set, you get this kind of thing that Marcus showed yesterday, which, you know, we refer to as the temporal kernel or temporal component of the receptive field. And it literally represents the average type of stimulus, at least in this sort of construction, that elicited a spike. And similarly, if you look at in the surrounding region, if you do the same kind of correlation and you play the same game, you get something that, and as was discussed previously, you get something that's, you know, typically, if you were to slice through time, you get something that's opposite of what you would find in the center. But also there's something interesting about the temporal profile of this, that it seems sluggish and longer, a little bit slower in terms of the processing, and that, you know, you can make arguments in the retina about the pathway in which this takes place through horizontal cells, et cetera, but it might have some interesting implications for information processing. That's not what I'm going to talk about. But then in the surrounding regions outside the receptive field, when we do this kind of averaging, we get nothing. Okay, so that's just the game that we play, and I can go through these pretty quickly. You know, we can think about it in a slightly different way, which is to say that we're imposing some kind of model on the relationship between the stimulus and the response, and that this is represented by some kind of linear spatiotemporal filter that then maps this three-dimensional space, right? Time, so two dimensions in space get mapped down to this scalar process that then eventually gives rise to the firing rate of the neurons, the firing activity of an individual neuron. And we typically also flip this around in time because this is really an impulse response of the pathway. So I'm not going to get into details of this because I don't think people are interested in this kind of thing here, but we spent a lot of deep time thinking about the right ways to estimate these kinds of things just from observing data. And so just in terms of background as well, is this a good model for neurons in the early visual pathway? Yes. It's been shown in retinal ganglion cells, and this is for a cat, X cell, anesthetized cat in the LGN. This shows the actual firing rate of the neuron. You know, the encoding model has been fit with another data set with a separate chunk of data, and then we predict how the cell actually responds, and this is the actual firing rate of the neuron, and this is reflected about the axis is what's predicted from this kind of model. So it's kind of simple, linear filtering of the stimulus, but it does a pretty good job, at least at this kind of gross temporal scale on 35 millisecond time scale. So we know also that it doesn't get, this kind of simple model doesn't get precise details of spike timing, not surprisingly. Okay, so that's just a bit of background about how this stuff goes. I think Mark has showed some of these just to give you a sense. This is a spatial-temporal M sequence. This is, you walk into any vision lab that does this kind of work. And this is what you would see on their display. Although I have to say, you would get the impression from this workshop that people use really intelligent or interesting stimuli in vision work, and it's not true. Probably 90% of people still use very simplistic sort of gratings and bars. So your sampling from your bias in terms of the sampling here. But then when you start talking about natural scenes, we don't really know what a natural scene is. But one thing we can say is that if you look at an individual pixel within the scene, the luminance profile over time looks drastically different from this, obviously. And in my early work in this domain, the kind of things that struck me were that, first of all, there are these very quick transients and non-stationarities in the luminance that falls into the receptive field of the cell. And they're also constantly changing contrast and mean luminance. And so we also heard yesterday and got into some lengthy discussion about contrast is really ill-defined in some sense. What does contrast mean for something like this? It's not really clear at all. Should we be talking about spectral, power in a certain range of the power of the spectrum, or should we define other measures? It's actually difficult to define. There are some accepted notions of contrast for these types of things, but I think they have some problems. So the things to think about is, an object moves into the field, and presumably what's happening here is it's dark and then all of a sudden bright. Is there anything going on there in terms of detection? Is our cells in the early visual pathway primed and ready to go for detecting this kind of object when it moves into the field? And similarly, when an object is in the field and the contrast and the luminance is sort of wiggling around, the mean luminance is changing and whatever notion you have of contrast is constantly changing. So the idea that there's a receptive field that's a static structure is just not present in all the most artificial conditions. So it's this sort of fluid representation that's constantly changing in response to these types of properties. So anyway, that's the motivation. Again, I'm not going to, for this crowd doesn't seem particularly interested in the details of this, but I'm happy to talk about these kind of things offline. But we think a lot about this particular problem, and so there's some complexities involved, right? This stimulus is being mapped by some kind of linear filter. Okay, that's simple enough. There's a nonlinear mechanism that maps this to, have an inherent rectification associated with representing, either firing rate or generating spikes out of a more sophisticated model. And then you have spike generation. And you have to think about things like the fact that refractory periods exist. So a cell fires and it doesn't fire again for a couple of milliseconds. And Mike and Marcus and a variety of other people have looked in great detail into the effects of this on coding. And it actually has dramatic effects in a lot of aspects of coding in certain conditions. So we've spent a lot of time thinking about how do we estimate these, given a spike train of data and a stimulus, how do we estimate these individual components? And more importantly for us, when these are changing over time, how do we deal with that? And how do we track properties as they're sort of evolving and changing over time, representing some change in the encoding mechanisms of the pathway? All right, so this is an example. This is from some salamander data from that Steve Back has collected in Marcus's lab. And this is, I'm not going to dwell on this thing, but this is this kind of switching experiment they do. And so it's high contrast, low contrast. This is mean lumen. This is a full field flicker onto salamander retina in a dish, and flickering back and forth between high contrast and low contrast, switching back and forth constantly. and recording extracellularly spike trains. And what we have focused on in the past is algorithms to track in single trials. So this is just a single trial of this kind of data, how the receptor field property changes. And so this is just showing the gain, essentially just the size of the the magnitude of the receptor field, the gain as it's changing, being modulated by the stimulus over time. So these are the kind of technical problems that we're interested in. And one thing the reason I brought this up, and I think this came up in Mike's talk the other day, I was curious about. So Steve Backus and Marcus published a paper a couple of years ago in which they recorded from lots of different types of retinal cells. And what they found was that under these kind of contrast switching experiments, that at first glance receptor field properties would change in response to these changes in the stimulus. But when they did intracellular recordings, what they found is that the baseline membrane potential would actually change as well. So what they did was then disentangled these two things and found that if we go back just one slide, they had a sort of a threshold nonlinearity here that had a variable threshold, but we can also think about that as just some kind of offset here that represents some just change in membrane potential, conceptually. Obviously, this is not a biophysical model. That when they estimated those two things separately, found that this baseline potential, so if you forget about that and just estimate receptor field properties, then what they found is that there's this very sort of slow adaptation. Time constant here is, maybe 15 seconds or so. But when they more carefully estimated, and this is re-estimates that we've done of this kind of thing, that this offset or the baseline membrane potential, if you can estimate that in parallel, what you get is that the receptor field changes very quickly in just the first, very short epoch of time following the switch in contrast. And then it's the offset here that actually has this kind of slow drift. It's this baseline potential that seems to be changing. So my only, statement here is that you, if one did not consider that property of the processing, you might reflect those changes back into the receptor field properties and think that, something's changing about the spatiotemporal integration. Of course, it's a completely functional model, so you could argue that the receptor field is completely a fake, or sort of, our own conception anyway. But anyway, this is what does happen when you estimate these kinds of things.
So let's see, in order to separately estimate gain and offset, you assume that the nonlinearity is kind of a rectification plus a slope, and make your best fit of those two parameters.
That's right. And strangely enough, I was a little concerned when we got into this that those two things would not be uniquely, because what happens is if you don't estimate this offset or this threshold, it can have a change in the magnitude of the kernels that you estimate. And I was worried that there was going to be sort of an ambiguity of being able to tease these things out. But it turns out, for whatever reason, because of the nonlinearity, you can actually get both of these things uniquely. And we've done a lot of simulations to show that's the case. So, anyway.
So how do you figure out what the offset is?
How do you figure out what the offset is? So this is...
Is it actually measurement?
No. So it's inferred. Yeah, so that's the thing, is if you go back to this, it's not something we have a direct measurement of. We have this.
It's a membrane potential.
That's correct.
Internal variable.
Right. So the only information we have that membrane potentials do change are studies like Steve and Marcus's, where they showed the membrane potential changes, and then other cortical studies that have shown that, that adaptation has a dramatic effect just on the baseline membrane potential. So we can infer that. We can't know that with these kind of recordings.
Can I also ask, is there an ambiguity between the amplitude of the filter and the gain?
The amplitude of this and then the slope of the nonlinearity, definitely.
We'll fix,
for instance, the slope of this and then estimate this. So those two things definitely, would work.
There's definitely ambiguity there. So I don't want to dwell too much on this. This is just, a little vignette of things to worry about and things to think about in terms of information processing and pathways, that yes, things are changing, but they're changing in a very complicated way. So
So why would it change the one change so quickly and another one? You know, it's kind of...
Why would the two things...
The behavior looks very strange because one of them is changing very quickly.
Yeah.
But another one doesn't match the speed.
So that's right. Result, so these two things are not matched.
As a result, the quick change is sort of kind of lost.
Yeah.
It's kind of useless.
That's right. So I don't know. I mean, I don't know why I would, if I were designing this, I'm not sure why I would put that in place. But this is what happens. There is a slow drift of membrane potential over this time course. I don't know why this is in place. Okay, so the other little vignette here that has to do with transmitting information is something Pam, I stuck this in there because Pam brought this up the other day. She's not here, but one of the things that we've been working on and worried about is how information is transmitted in the pathway in exposed to white noise versus different types of natural scene movies. And one immediate question you'd like to ask, and I think there's no good answer to this, and it would be really fun to talk about this in detail, would be that we know that these adaptation mechanisms are in place. So people have studied this for 40 years, you know, it's starting in the retina. So these are just really well known and really well characterized. Changes in mean luminance induce dramatic changes in encoding properties, changes in contrast. When we have a natural scene, for example, though, we have changes in mean luminance, changes in contrast that are coupled. We don't know how those interact at all. They're thought to be different mechanisms. We don't know how those interact. We don't know, for example, do receptive fields or do encoding mechanisms adapt to correlation structure in the scenes? And you would think, well, contrast, I know they adapt to change the contrast, so they must have some effect. The natural scenes must induce some kind of effect on the way the cells encode information. And so the jury's still out on that, and I'll tell you our take on it. Did Jack Gallant give a talk here? I know he was here, so he may have discussed this. And their group found, I think in V1, that there are some changes in receptive field properties that they see in response to these two different types of stimuli. But what I'm about to show you is a case where it's a null result, that we didn't see this, at least in the thalamus. So one thing you see is that when you take a stimulus, you take the stimulus both temporally and spatially, one characteristic is the white noise is flat spectrally, and the movies on average have this kind of, on a log plot, have this linear fall off. And the slope of this depends on the movie, and it usually falls off like 1 over F, and there's an exponent there that ranges some, and I think Dao Wei Dong talked in some detail about this. Was there something? Oh, okay. So the question is, what effect does this correlation structure have on the encoding? You would think that it has something. And in particular, there was a study by Yang Dan, Joe Attic, and Clay Reed in 96 that was really provocative. And so here's the story, and Pam talked about this. So here is the power spectrum of the response of neurons. And this is, every trace here represents a different neuron. And they're all thalamic neurons. And what they see is in response to natural scene movies, that the response of the neuron was flat spectrally. Okay, so it's completely whitened in some sense. However, the response to white noise has this kind of upward trend like this. Okay, so what's implied or implicit in this analysis is that, for instance, starting with the natural scenes, that it has this kind of...
Was that Sakata animal?
No, this is anesthetized animal.
I'm surprised it was that way. Okay.
So here's a power spectrum of, just pictorially, power spectrum of natural scene. And I think they did most of their analysis in terms of temporal dynamics. So you can take these Fs as being the temporal. Obviously, this one is a response, so it's temporal. Falls off like this, and the power in the output is flat. And so what's implicit in there is there's some encoding that generally has this kind of high pass element to it, because it's got to balance the low pass of this to give you something flat. And furthermore, when they showed white noise, which is flat, they saw the response that looks like that. So that would say, well, look, there's an encoding scheme here that's high pass, and it doesn't change between these two things, and it's just a static filter that does this kind of high pass filtering. So the thing that really intrigued us was that to say, well, look, gosh, this is all over the place. You know, if this thing were just a nice tight band here, I would say, okay, that's pretty convincing. But this thing is all over the place. And so, yes, generally there's a trend upward like this, but there's also a bunch of them that I would argue that look pretty flat. And so, you know, you could argue about where to draw the line and say, well, it's flat versus it's tilted. But, you know, I would argue that there's at least some percentage of cells here that seem to be flat here and the same cells flat here. So that would imply that there's something, if the output spectrum is flat for both inputs and the inputs have very different structure, then that would imply that the cells are somehow adapting to that correlation structure and changing their behavior. So that's the story, and I think Pam went after the same thing. And
spatial correlations are relevant. Spatial, those two stimuli, we have different spatial correlations, right?
That's right.
Where it was just flickering.
So that's, yeah, so it's, this, no, it's, a, it's so it's the spatiotemporal white noise, so each pixel independent, and then spatiotemporal natural scene. So that the coupling between the two is kind of problematic, I think, as well. But the two stimuli were completely different temporally and spatially in terms of it. So if you looked at, I think I had a slide way, way back that had, this is the temporal spectrum and this is spatial. And when you look at these, you know, this is flat and these two temporally and spatially are. But, you know, there's a lot of problems with this because this, you know, you assume this sort of temporal spatial separability and it's not a good assumption, but it's sort of the best we can do at the moment. So one of the things I haven't talked about is that most people, the biologists, tend to think that, you know, the story ends with a white noise stimulus, you do spike-triggered average or reverse correlation, and you get the receptive field, and that's the end of the story. But the fact is that the stimulus need not be white in any sense. It can have correlation structure in it, but you just have to deal with that in terms of the estimation and come up with a filter that doesn't depend on that. And so we spent a lot of time working on this problem, and I know Jack Gallant and Dario Ringach and a couple of other folks have worked on this problem. And so the only thing to say here is that let's see. These two type movie classes, the movie falls off, like, in temporally is 1 over omega to the m, this exponent. M is about 1.5. People who do a lot of natural scenes will tell you usually somewhere between 1 and 2, and at least for this class of movies we used, it averaged out to be about 1.5. Spatially, it averaged out to be about 1.3, so it's 1 over spatial frequency to exponent. Okay, so so the question is, can we estimate, from these kind of data, this kind of stimulus, can we estimate what the receptive fields are? And can we, and one of the things I didn't say is that in the DAN study, they implied that the filters were the same in the two cases, but didn't explicitly show that. So they just said, look, the input's like this, the output's like that, therefore what's in between must be like this. So we were after that particular question. Technical point, I can gloss over this in 30 seconds, is that the correlation structure, the more correlated the scene becomes, what happens is you end up having to invert a correlation matrix. There are lots of different ways to do this that avoid explicit inversion, but it's sort of implicit in all of this. And so what happens is the condition number of this matrix that you have to invert is it's the ratio of the largest eigenvalue to the smallest eigenvalue. When this thing gets really big, you start to have problems. And so what happens is, and what we first did, we saw changes in receptive fields and thought, ah, we got it, this is it. And it turned out to be something that was just completely an artifact of the estimation. So the point is that the scenes can be correlated, but there seems to be, in terms of estimate error, there seems to be this kind of elbow that occurs around 1.5 or so, where if the scenes become too correlated, if the slope gets steeper and steeper and steeper, it's more correlated, then you start to have problems doing the estimation. So at least under our conditions, experimental conditions, and lengths of data sets and things like that. So we did a pretty careful analysis of all this and found at least for the movies that were not that correlated, that had this slope of about 1.5, that the receptive fields in response, these are LGN X cells,
from anesthetized cat were the same under noise conditions and movie conditions. And so remember, one of these has a flat spectrum, the other one has a tilt to it. And if you're careful and estimate these, then you actually get the same thing. So this was a null result. So this was kind of disappointing in some sense. You know, you had this idea of how you want the study to turn out, and then it turns out like this, and then no one wants to publish it. So then lots of different cells, they look identical. So this was one question that Pam brought up that I thought needed to be sort of readdressed, but basically didn't find any difference. Okay, so now I've talked about task-dependent processing. I'll switch a little bit to the detection side of this. By the way, a lot of this stuff is just brand new, so I threw in everything new that I could think of. So detection. Are cells in the early visual pathway, is there an element of detection? We know that they're good at transmitting fine details, and I can predict, you know, I can reconstruct visual scenes and say something about the fine spatial detail, but the question is, if I'm an animal in the woods and something moves, I need to know that. And so the information is all coming through this pathway, and there's some idea that there are sort of modes of transmission versus detection that are distinctly different. And that's very controversial. I think it's kind of fun to talk about here. So I'm going to talk about this in the context of bursting. So one thing that the thalamus does, and a lot of brain regions do, is that it bursts. It generates very rapid successions of spikes. And there's a biophysical mechanism behind this. It's a calcium, it's a hyperpolarization and then a calcium current that where spikes ride on top of this wave. And so people have studied this in slice for a long time. And initially it was thought that this was not something that was elicited by a visual stimulus in the pathway, that it was just some kind of sleep-related thing. And people know that if you're really, you know, sleeping or deeply anesthetized, then lots of bursting occurs. And whereas when you're awake, you know, that's the conventional thought. And so a lot of people still think that bursts are not visually evoked. And so, you know, to do this right, you have to do intracellular recordings in the intact animal to understand this, which you know, could be difficult. But what we've done is, and people have gone through, Murray Sherman, for example, has done a lot of work in trying to understand, suppose I have an extracellular recording of just spikes. And what's the criterion for defining what a burst actually is? And if you pair it with intracellular recordings in slice, you can develop a criterion that helps you understand, well, yes, when this sequence of spikes occurs, preceded by a long period of silence, so usually defined as 100 milliseconds of silence, that there's a rapid succession of spikes, and each separated by less than 4 milliseconds. That is how they've defined burst and sort of correlated that with intracellular recordings. So you see a lot of these in thalamic activity. So I'll define burst as the sort of normal way, the conventional way to do it.
Why does there have to be such a big gap before?
There's a prolonged hyperpolarization of the cell. So it's necessary to that the cell becomes sort of primed for this calcium current. Mm-hmm. There's millions of papers on that if you're interested in this kind
but
of
thing. But the other areas which have bursts where there's not a big gap, for example, and so it just so happens in this case.
I think this is kind of a controversial thing, but I think that this is how people have defined burst, I think, independent of brain region.
I see.
But I, you know, no, that's, is it not true?
That's how people define burst in the LGN, because there's this, you know, specific ion channel that is kind of involved in generating that very, you know, stereotype burst. You know, so mm-hmm.
So you think this is specific to LGN?
This is kind of LGN specific. I mean, more generally, one thinks of a burst as you know,
very high frequency discharge.
Yeah, you know, it's kind of a set of short interval spikes that you know, whose intervals are kind of much more common than in, let's say, a Poisson model.
That's right.
of the neurons. So kind of statistically unusually likely.
Yeah.
So that's certainly how, you know, we usually think of it in retina, and, you know, Hubel and Macnick have been working.
Yeah.
And we kind of take that that type of approach. So
I guess it's the case that there's been unusually large amount of studies done in the thalamus and LGMD.
Yeah, it's this ion channel is known, and it has this DNA activation
property
that has a long time constant. That's where the 100 milliseconds comes from, so you can isolate the current study.
So, I mean, let me make a disclaimer. This is dicey business because, you know, to claim that this is some calcium current induced sequence of action potentials, there's no way I can prove that to you with these kind of data. And the other caveat to all of this, I'll say, is that that anesthesia seems to have some effect on this as well. And so the data I'll show are from barbiturate anesthetized animal cat. And there's a clear relationship between anesthesia and bursting. So you have to be a little bit careful, but it's fun to talk about anyway. So and then the burst percentage I'll talk about as being the percentage of spikes in the entire spike train that are involved in a burst. So you can imagine if I've defined this as a burst, then there's three spikes here, two spikes here,
I think it's worth pointing out that it sort of doesn't matter from a coding standpoint whether this was really due to the calcium channel
right.
or not,
because yeah.
V1 doesn't know that.
Yeah.
It sees the spike.
That's right. So what he's getting ahead to is, you can imagine the utility of this is I'm in the thalamus and I'm going to project my neurons to the cortex. This very, very high frequency stimulus, three spikes in eight milliseconds, and it's been shown that this kind of activity has a large effect or large increases the probability of eliciting a spike in the downstream neuron. So you can imagine if your goal is to say, hey, wake up, or hey, listen to me, this might be a good way to do it regardless from a coding strategy, this might be a good way to do it regardless of the underlying mechanism. But there's a baggage with this field that you inherit if you start thinking about it. So what we notice is that the cells burst in response to both white noise stimuli. So this is an LGNX cell in response to a full field, I'm sorry, not full, spatiotemporal white noise, and they burst. However, in response to movies, the movie stimulus, natural scenes, they burst very reliably and a lot more. And so the mean firing rate on average between these two stimuli about the same, so that's shown with lots of a population of cells here, but the burst percentage is significantly higher for cells responding to the movies. Okay, and there's also this issue of contrast, and it's an issue that's been brought up a couple of times, and being able to say, well, this is the same contrast as this. Do you define contrast in some conventional sense, or do you look at it through the eyes of the receptive field and look at the output of the receptive field and look at that function, size of that? And I think the jury's out. It's not really clear. The best we can say is that these are roughly the same contrast by some measures that we've used. That's so here's just qualitatively what's happening. Here's some scenes from movies, and here's a guy walking along, and here's the receptive field of the cell. So this scale bar shows about a degree and a half of visual space. And these are, frame one, frame three, frame five, et cetera, from a natural scene movie shown at, these effectively inner frame intervals would be between frame one and two would be about 30 milliseconds or so. And so you have 60 milliseconds between these. So you can see that the leg, this is center and surround of the cell. Leg coming, so here, there's not a whole lot going on inside the receptive field. Leg comes into the receptive field, and by frame five here, the receptive field becomes full of this very high luminance stimulus, and then you get this burst. And this is repeated trials for the same cell in response to this kind of stimulus. And then presumably what's happening, if you believe the Murray Sherman story about burst and tonic firing, is that the burst sort of starts things, and then it's flips into tonic firing because I want to know some details about this guy's leg. So we have lots of examples like this where, here's something black and seen. By the way, it works the opposite direction as well. For this is an on cell, but there are off cells that do the opposite of this. Here's a black scene. Something comes into the receptive field here, and all of a sudden, triggers this thing. And the gray indicate where we've defined the bursts. And then similarly with this one, here's a scene from Woods. here's a, you know, black inside the receptive field, something starts to come in, and then by this frame, you know, there you are, and it happens in every single frame of every single repeat in response to this kind of stimulus. So qualitatively, you say, well, okay, that's you know, that's, you know, you in some ways you would expect this, right? There's nothing in the field, and there's no, I mean, this is incredibly silent. And then all of a sudden, something very bright comes in the field, so it's kind of like sticking an edge in there. I got to start somewhere. So then we could say, well, are there features in the natural scenes that actually seem to elicit the response, the bursting? So like with the spike-triggered average, we can look at a spike and look at the stimulus that precedes it. And we'll do this with white noise because we don't want to have the correlation structure of the natural scene to contaminate this. So it does still burst to white noise. And so we'll look at tonic spikes, spikes not part of a burst, and look at the spike triggered average of that. And then we'll do the same thing with bursts. And we'll, every time a burst occurs, we'll say, well, what's the stimulus that preceded it, and so on and so on. And when you do that, you get something that looks like this. So what happens is that the black is the tonic spikes, and this is our normal sort of kernel that we talk about, you know, temporal part of the receptive field. And shown in gray is that associated with the burst. And so you would, you know, if you're paying attention, you might say, well, you know, you've defined it as such. I mean, you've defined the fact that it's silent for some period of time, and then it's rapidly active. And so, in some ways, you know, that's definitely true. So we've done lots of work on trying to play with the numbers. Is 100 milliseconds important, or 120 milliseconds, 150 milliseconds, 80 milliseconds is a silence? The time interval between spikes, it doesn't seem to really matter. You get this kind of feature that comes out of it. And what you've also done is linked the stimulus to the burst. So we know that the cell needs to be silent, but we're also saying that the stimulus is actually inducing that, or at least correlated with it. And then I should have the frequency response, you know, and this in the frequency domain, it'd be easy to see. But so what we can say is that these kernels, we can also think of it as a piece of stimulus that has a certain structure. It has a certain correlation function. And so the tonic one is a little bit more peaked here and tight, centered around zero as a correlation, as a function of lag in milliseconds, whereas the one associated with the burst is more broad. So spectrally speaking, this would have more lower frequency component to it. So this is just a little bit ambiguous in terms of, well, unless you're used to looking at these things. When you look at the stimulus, the white noise is obviously a delta function of a correlation. The correlation function is a delta function because it's white, whereas the movie tends to fall off like you would expect. So it has a lot more low frequency components to it that tend to produce this kind of burst. And so it actually explains, or at least shows you why the natural scenes tend to produce more bursts than tonic spikes. But, you know, again, the reason I like this story is because it's just completely, you know, very few times have I ever had a story that actually made this kind of logical sense without having to explain a lot. So then we said, well, okay, you know, how good can we model this? And so there are models. For instance, John Renzel and others worked on a model for bursting through this calcium current mechanism. It's an integrate and fire kind of thing. And it was a biophysical model, but we sort of adapted it and said, okay, well, we can take an integrate and fire mechanism. We can stick a burst, you know, we can have a burst current associated with that as well and just run it like that. And so this just shows an integrate and fire model in response to a segment of the visual stimulus, and this shows the integrate and fire burst model, the Smith et al. Burst model that has this additional, it's triggered by a long hyperpolarization. You need this long hyperpolarization, then it kicks in this calcium current, and all of a sudden you get this really nice sort of very, very high frequency information at the beginning. So down at the bottom, the stars indicate when bursts actually occur in the real data. So we're running stimulus through these two models, and then we're also showing where the actual cell bursts. And what we see is that when the here's the PSTH, it's sort of shown in gray. is the actual cell firing in response to this particular stimulus. And what we can see is both the integrate and fire and integrate and fire burst model. What happens is, so the models are fit independently, and they're fit in such a way that the integrate and fire model is sort of optimal, you know, minimizing the mean squared error for what it does. And the integrate and fire burst model is optimized separately, so they're not, you know, you're not sort of stacking the deck. So what happens is at this moment in time, there's a very large actual response to the neuron. The integrate and fire or burst model, IFB, matches that, whereas the integrate and fire model just sort of has a little blip here. And there are many cases in which it just doesn't fire at all. The cell just doesn't fire. So you can see it here. The cell, the integrate and fire model just doesn't fire at all. However, here is an example where there's an initial onset of activity. The integrate and fire burst seems to get some of that, but then the integrate and fire model sort of comes on and eventually picks up the tonic activity that follows the burst. So, and I think this is sort of another example of a similar thing. When there's not a burst, the cells seem to, both models seem to track equally well. So the story here is that you know, whatever the mechanism is, there's some kind of nonlinear amplification that says, okay, when there's been a long silence, when I do respond, I'm gonna respond big. And you can't really explain that with just a regular sort of integrated fire model and still get all the tonic activity. You could bump the gain up. You can imagine just bumping up the gain. But then when you have tonic firing, you totally overestimate. So there's this kind of, you know, it's initially big and then it tails off.
So is that an ion channel based model, or is that kind of a phenomenological model where there's a spike after potential that has an excitatory load?
It's a biophysical model, so it looks a lot like a sort of a, I mean, it has all the currents.
It has explicit.
Yeah, so it feels a little funny to do that because I'm sort of matching it with a
cube H sort of.
Exactly. So it's a good paper, the Renzo Smith et al. Paper. Okay, so I think I'm just about done with that story. I think the only thing to say here is that, again, these are just more raster plots of cells bursting. And so this is one cell that has a receptive field. You know, when you do these kind of experiments, you line up the monitor so that the receptive field is right in the center, and so you end up with lots of cells that have very similar receptive fields, even if they're from different animals. So this is, two cells from two different animals that have very similar receptive fields, and then the corresponding rasters with all the burst mark with little asterisks here.
So in a model like that, how do you fix the linear filter? Do you take it from white noise, or do you?
We take it from white noise. That's right. Yeah. So then there's the whole contrast issue. Well, all right. So I don't need to show the summary plot because, basically the integrate and fire burst seems to capture something that the integrate and fire model doesn't. And there's this nonlinear amplification. So, if you sort of believe my story about transmitting information versus detecting, and, you don't have to believe that. Not required. That during transmission, the visual system constantly adapts to changes in the scene. And I think that's the interesting thing, and I think that makes life difficult. And we don't know if signals, this came up. I think Bill brought this up yesterday. Is something transmitting signals down the pathway and saying, well, hey, the mean luminance is this, and so here's how to interpret what you're going to get from this cell. Or is it that you don't care? Or is it, there's lots of, or is it that we're missing something that actually in the cells there is something about mean luminance and contrast? But if everything is kind of relative, it makes it difficult to interpret what you're hearing, right, at downstream neurons. And then adaptation to correlation structure is still not clear. Stephen David was a student with Jack Gallant who worked on this, and they see it in the cortical cells. When they estimate receptive fields, they see changes in the receptive fields in response to changes in correlation structure and stimulus. So the jury's kind of out on this. I think Dario Ringach also saw, he worked with Bob Shapley, also saw some differences in their V1 cells, but these are filamentous. And then bursting may or may not serve as a mechanism for detection, selectively engaged by object motion in the scene. And we don't, how does this happen? Well, as has been brought up, the LGN, the thalamus, receives a lot of feedback from cortex. And so the cartoonish model that people like to talk about is that the thalamus is sitting there
and you're not really paying attention to anything, you're in this kind of burst state, you're ready, and all of a sudden something comes into the scene, big signal for the cortex, cortex sends projections back down that somehow kick you into, I mean, this is a hard thing to prove, but kicks you into a tonic mode and says, give me some more information about the stimulus. So now that I know it's here, tell me about it. So.
So I have a couple questions here. So first of all, about what you're just mentioning, I thought that just the biophysics of the relay neuron itself is enough to explain these differences, because the calcium channel partially inactivates, and
yeah.
So it's not available to trigger a burst after depolarization.
Right. Right. So it's true. It's kind of self-regulating, right?
Why exactly does that need?
It doesn't. You're totally right. That following a burst, it's almost just, well, biophysically, it kicks into tonic firing mode. And then also by the definitions we've imposed here, it's in tonic firing mode. So you're right. The only thing I could say is that maybe, certainly neuromodulators are involved in setting up the conditions for the initiation of a burst, but maybe not turning it off.
I thought a lot of feedback was probably inhibitory because it goes to the nucleus reticularis directly.
I don't think I've read a convincing argument as to how this might, it's all very, very speculative. I think even, there have been papers for, 15 years on this, but I think there still feel very speculative, and I'm hoping someone works this out, but as the feedback is very, very complicated because, and the other non-cortical projections, non-retinal and non-cortical projections to the thalamus further complicate things. So,
those are probably not rapidly modulated in conditions like this. Okay, but my other question is, what exactly is the distinction between transmission and detection here?
I think as a so this is the interesting question. I think as a downstream neuron, so I think about this in terms of a signal-to-noise problem. And so it is also true that in burst conditions, there seems to be a lower sort of baseline firing rate. And so when you do get a firing activity, you get a very large chunk of spikes. And so in some ways, this contrast between before the object gets there and when the object does get there is large. As opposed to the situation where, in the tonic firing, there tends to be a larger sort of baseline fire, a higher baseline firing rate that sort of twiddles around this. So I don't know that I would make a clean distinction between the two, but all I would say is that in one situation, it seems like you're trying to maximize the signal-to-noise ratio in one sense of suppress everything, but when something gets through, make it really big, versus another situation where don't suppress so much, let the fluctuations through, and so I want to feel the details, but I don't know. That's just my thinking. So to switch gears slightly, I'll try to make this one really short, because I know people, it's been an hour or so. So I'm just going to say, and usually what happens in talks and when you talk to biologists is that, there's some people who like vision and then they don't like the rat whiskers, and then there's people who like rat whiskers and don't like vision. It's very sort of weird. But so rats have these really extensive arrays of whiskers on their face, and anyone who's ever worked with laboratory rats, they're constantly moving their whiskers, and it's an active sensory modality. So they can move their whiskers like in this huge arc around their face. They can also twiddle them at very high frequencies. They constantly brush them up against surfaces and objects. There's a lot of people who feel like the visual system is not that well. The acuity of the visual system is not it's not that great, so this may serve as this and the olfactory system may serve as major sensory modalities for this animal. It's been from 1905 on. People have started doing work on this pathway and shown that it's critical for the animal. If you trim them off, all sorts of
impairments of the animal, critical for discrimination, orientation, local motion, balance, et cetera, emotional state, some happy. And so here's some details on what they are. But the thing that really appealed to me in this whole thing was that, you know, you have this motor pathway that's controlling where these things are, and then you have the sensory pathway that tells you something about what's coming in contact with it. And I think the sensory motor integration problem is, you know, one problem that really needs to be solved in the field. And we sort of, you know, usually sort of, you know, slice off a piece of this, and I'm going to do that today. But this is long term why I want to get involved in the system, is that the behavior, the motor activity, although still complicated, generally is in a plane, and so it's not very complicated. And I think we do stand some chance of understanding this loop. So I don't know why David Kleinfeld's not here. I think he would really love this meeting, so he would have been a good person to have here, I think.
He will be here.
Oh, he will be here. Okay, good. That's good. So maybe he talks about the motor side of this in detail, so this would be really good. So back, you know, 10 or 15 years ago, two groups in parallel showed that that rats, blindfolded rats, could discriminate between different textures of very subtly different detail. So this is sort of a gap experiment. So the rats trained to run out here, and they've been blindfolded in some way, and there's a gap here, and they do the experiment such they train the animal with the gap, with the texture really close, and then eventually sort of move it so far away that it can only be in contact with the whiskers. And, you know, they do a lot of controls to make sure it's not olfactory, et cetera, et cetera. And what they found is that a smooth surface versus a textured surface, that animal can discriminate and then jump across to the one they're trained to, you know, this another platform they can jump across. And what they found was that the surface, there's one surface that's smooth, the other one is textured. The textured one, they could have a surface as small as the grooves were about 90 micron spacing and 30 microns deep. And so this is, you know, okay, so human fingertip, I think, can go further down than this. But this is pretty small grading, high-frequency grading. And so you might not think that an animal like this could do this. And this was also, in some ways, anecdotal, because they actually, this was just found serendipitously, because this was a pre-processing stage for machining this, where they then made bigger grooves. But they said, well, what the hell, let's try it. And they tried this one, and they found that he could do it. And that was the end of the study. So there's no telling that if this is the limit of the discrimination or not. So we don't know. And a lot of labs are starting to poke around on this, and we're one of them. So I better go home and get busy. So just a couple of comments about, no one knows much about, or a lot of people don't know much about this pathway. But what's appealing is, if you're not an born experimentalist and you're all thumbs, this is a good one to work on, because it's a really attractive preparation. On the face, there are these the whiskers are arranged in this very neatly arranged array. These are blood sinuses on the. This is a slice off the face, and these are the blood sinuses that surround each follicle. And around there are mechanoreceptors that sense when the whiskers deflected. This is flipped, but this is the cortical. This is the cortex, the stain, the cytochrome oxidase stain of the cortex. And this shows chunks, columns of cells in the cortex that map directly to the face. And so all the way at the cortex, you still have this really nicely preserved topographical map that at first looks very simple, but it's not that simple. But at least, you know, the scale bars here, you can experimentally, you can cut a hole in the cortex, in the skull, stick an electrode in there, and you're off and running. So
so what is alpha, beta?
Oh, where am I? Alpha, beta. Yeah, these are called the Greek whiskers. They're the main whiskers here, and then people have called these whiskers that are sort of in between the Greek whiskers, and they've labeled them alpha, beta, gamma, and delta.
So why they're not represented?
Are they not? Let's see. Are they not? I think they are, but let's see. Yeah, I don't know. I didn't do the stain. Hopefully I referenced Pete Land. Yeah, I don't know. And it actually makes it worse, because there are also what they call macrovibrissae, these long ones, and then there's all these little ones, if you've ever looked at a rat. So
there's all these little ones here, and no one knows what they do. No one has a clue. And so clearly the rat knows what it's doing, because it'll come up and rub its face and things and rub these little microvibrissa, and it's... I'll show you a couple of... Well, I don't think you'll see that.
So what does how the sensors work? Is it like proprioceptors?
So in the soft tissue that surrounds the hair follicle, there are mechanoreceptors that when the tissue deforms, they become active. So there's a bunch of little strain gauges around the outside of it. And then in fact, this is what happens. So in the face, you have this. It's embedded in soft tissue around these, you know, cantilever beams, and then it gets transmitted to directly to the brainstem, then the thalamus, and then cortex. So it's sort of a normal sort of progression. Well, you know, minus the brainstem, but like the visual pathway has a thalamocortical, and that's kind of our interest eventually is the thalamocortical loop problem. So then, you know, this is an experiment we do. This is the acute experiment. The anesthetized animal's sitting here, and we can use a piezoelectric bending actuator to wiggle the whiskers around. We cut a hole in the head and stick an electrode down in the tissue and amplify the signal and get single, you can discriminate single unit activity pretty easily. So I think it's a good, it would be a good classroom preparation as well, I think, for studying some sort of coding thing. This I stuck in here, it's not really relevant for the talk here, but Marcus yesterday spent a lot of time talking about novelty detection. So it turns out these whiskers, when you stick an electrode in cortex and you wiggle the whisker, it turns out they have a directional tuning. So if you wiggle it in one direction, so I've done the whole polar plot here. If you wiggle it in one direction, maybe in response to one deflection, there's just a little blip of firing activity, whereas in the opposite direction, there's a large response. And so the polar plot represents the magnitude of the response as a function of the angle with which you deflect it. And the reason I put this on here is this is just a side detail, but there's some evidence coming out from other labs that when they wiggle the whisker in one direction, there's an adaptation. So if you repeatedly wiggle like this, and then all of a sudden you do it in that direction, that it turns out this plot changes. So it turns out that you start to sort of depress things in one dimension, but then enhance the response in another direction. So I think it's a similar kind of effect. I think people have seen this in a lot of different pathways. So it might be that, you know, the rat's running along, brushing his whisker, and then all of a sudden something changes and needs to detect that. So,
But the whisker movement, you said, is always one-dimensional?
The whisker movement, it's more like ellipsoidal, unfortunately. I'm kind of lying a little bit. But also when, you know, the head moves, and so when it comes in contact with different surfaces, it can be in all sorts of different, you know, the whisker can kind of curve upwards, and there's some problems with that. So the problem that we're interested in is at the moment sort of a transmission one, but I'll tie it back into the detection one. But as the whisker comes in contact with a texture, there's some sequence of deflections of the whisker. And, by the way, some robotics groups are starting to get interested in this kind of thing, too, because they want to instrument robots for situations in where, there's no vision is not possible. Or maybe in addition to vision, you'd have some kind of probes that would stick out from the robot. And people have worked on lobsters and related things. So there's sequences of deflections. And so what we look at is saying, well, let's break this apart into an individual deflection versus a pair versus a triplet and try to build up some way in which the cell responds to a structure. And the basic finding is that when you deflect the whisker, there's a response. And when you deflect it again, so I told this a condition stimulus and a test stimulus, there's a response here to the second one. And the reason this one is smaller is actually it's in the opposite direction, so it's sort of you deflect it up and then deflect it back, but I just show these as condition and test. When you bring these closer together in time, this one is slightly suppressed, and then finally when it's very short in time, this one's completely suppressed. So that's one basic finding, and you can summarize that with this kind of plot here that shows, as a function of the time interval between the two, how big is the response relative to where it would be in isolation.
And so the time course of this post-excitatory suppression, we can characterize by this, you know, how quickly it gets to half of its maximum. It's not, there are a lot of mechanisms that could give rise to this because it's cortex. And so, you know, one thing is this synaptic depression. I mean, you can get synaptic depression even just in one, you know, from thalamocortical synapse, you can get a depression after just one spike. So there's a lot of things to say about this, but
what is that slow thing after, in the first figure?
Oh, here.
Yeah, and also after the first one.
Yeah, so sometimes, and I didn't focus on that here, but sometimes there's a initial response, then another response after some period of time. And people think this is, some calcium kind of current that the cell becomes very hyperpolarized and then comes back up out of that, and you see even a secondary. It's very clear in intracellular recording, so Barry Connors and Brown does a lot of work like this, and they've shown that there's this, you know, initial EPSP, long IPSP sort of inhibited activity, and then a burst, a second hump. And what's neat, so I'm not going to show that here, is that when the stimulus is at a frequency that hits that second one, you get sort of almost like a resonance in the system, or it's electrical, in the sense that it's not a mechanic, it's not the resonance of the whiskers. But when you hit that, you actually facilitate the response. So there seems to be sort of a sweet spot that, strangely enough, corresponds to about 6 or 8 hertz, which is the frequency at which the rats whisk. And that seems to be a signature frequency that occurs in a lot of the brain.
But it's gone in the third one.
Yeah, and I don't know. I mean, so it does appear in some of these recordings, but like you said, it's not there. So.
But that's not.
I don't think that's anything. It's just data being finicky. So the thing that got us out of this was that when you have a triplet here, condition, and test, the interesting thing, one thing that could have been very uninteresting is that the first one could have sort of suppressed the second one, which then could suppress the third one, and then everything just goes away, and that would be kind of boring. But what's interesting that happens is the first one, when this time interval is very long, the second, there's a response to the second one, but no response to the third, because this is very short. But when you bring this a little bit closer together, the first one suppresses the second one, but then lifts the suppression on the third one. And so you get this kind of seesaw action, right? So what's going on is that not only are you suppressing the excitatory response here, but you're suppressing the post, you know, the inhibition that follows that. And so we have some ideas about how that might work in terms of a circuit model, in terms of thalamocortical circuitry. But for the purpose of what I'm talking about here, so what happens when these are really short is you get complete suppression. So for the purpose of what I'm talking about here is what happens, and we saw this in a lot of data, in our lab and other groups, they show PSTHs like this, post-stimulus time histograms, in response to a periodic stimulus. And what happens is that you see the first one response is really big, second response is a little bit smaller, next one's really big. What happens is the first one suppresses the second one, which then lifts the suppression on the third, and so on, and you get this kind of seesaw. And we saw it in our data, and a lot of people saw it in their data. And in a sort of an adaptation study, they would say, well, you know, there's what's happening here is that there's this adaptation that's taking place. At least the way we see it is that it's exactly this phenomenon, just sort of, you know, extrapolated out in sort of to a repetitive stimulus like this, and it's completely predictable just from this one. You know, we don't know the mechanism, so it could be a synaptic depression, it could be a cortical inhibition. It's very likely there's a chunk of the thalamus, the reticular thalamus that has inhibitory inputs into the relevant thalamic region that you know, we're seeing it cortex, we're moving down the thalamus to figure this out more carefully. So there's not a whole, you know, I could talk about that for a long time, that's not really the point, but there's, you know, these things are completely predictable. So the frequency response of the cell, if you expose it to frequencies, at, you know, different, stimuli at different frequencies, what you get, actual versus predicted, are very well matched just based on this simple, you know, simple characterization of how the cell responds to two deflections. And then you can predict sort of arbitrary, you know, here's an arbitrary deflection pattern, and here's a spike raster of it, and actual versus predicted, and it just tracks. You know, you get this very weird behavior that might seem kind of irregular and unreliable, but in fact, it's very predictable. Okay, but anyway, so back to our big picture thing here, which was, what does this mean for the animal, right? I mean, that's ultimately important. And so in thinking about how the animal actually comes up to a texture and moves his whisker along the texture, there's some relevant variables to consider. One is, you know, suppose I have two textures. Well, the spacing, you know, this little D here, the spacing between the whiskers, big D, you know, how many whiskers you have, the length of the whiskers, the angular velocity with which the whiskers move across. So I would call those all extrinsic, although you can say that the velocity is something that's caused by the animal. But, you know, for the moment, see, these are things outside the animal. Versus intrinsic is this suppression. So remember I showed the sigmoidal plot that said, well, when you deflect once, you know, there's some period of time for which the cell has to recover before it can respond again. This is, by the way, this is not just a cell sort of after hyperpolarization, or, you know, we think this is more of a network phenomenon. But what's interesting is in Miguel Nicolelis' lab, they've done a lot of work on this in wake animals versus anesthetized animals. And what they found is that in anesthetized or quiescent animals, so animals just completely, you know, rats, they have all these weird behaviors. And sometimes they just kind of sit there and you just think, you know, they're like students in class, right? You're sort of wondering, are they alive? You know, you sort of want to poke them with a stick or something. And they're not doing anything, and they're not even really paying attention. And they tend to have this time course like this. So much longer time course of recovery from the suppression. And as we go more towards the awake or alert state, awake and alert state, this time course is actually quite a bit faster. So it doesn't seem to be as suppressed as much. So this is kind of an intrinsic property of the pathway. And so the question is, you know, how do these things affect? So if we fix, for example, the velocity, because when, as David Kleinfeld will show you, I think, the within a whisking bout of the animal, the velocity, angular velocity, is relatively fixed. So it'll, you know, it'll sort of pick out of a barrel, you know, 5 hertz or 8 hertz, and it'll stick with that for some period of, you know, a few seconds, and then stop. And then a few seconds later, we'll do it again, and it'll be 10 hertz, but it'll be fixed. And so there's a sort of, you pick one, you stick with it for a little while, and then you start over. So it's kind of an interesting thing. But if you're thinking about it from a discrimination problem, and how is information being transmitted in this, and is the relevant information there, we can play a game and say, well, suppose I have two textures, and I observe cortical activity. Layer 4 in the cortex receives, you know, all of the thalamic inputs, all of the relevant information. So it's all there waiting for you. You just have to pull it out. And if you sit here as an ideal observer, we might be able to say, well, can you tell the difference between texture 1 and texture 2 based just on the cortical activity that you observe? And so, you know, obviously one thing that happens is if you fix the D, the spacing of the grating, and we're trying to look for the difference between a texture D and D plus delta D, some very small variation in that. I think it was like a 5% difference. That when you stimulate here at a certain frequency, suppose that the T50, the time course of the suppression, it's really slow to recover, then what happens, you can imagine, it responds to the first one and then it just doesn't do anything ever again, right? And so, however, if this is a little bit shorter, then if you notice here, it's responding to every other one, which we see also experimentally. We see this a lot. And then finally, if it gets shorter, then it responds more. And then finally, if it's really short, I don't know what the number here is. It must have been around 20 milliseconds. Then it seems to respond to all this, you know, it responds very reliably to this periodic stimulus. And you can play the same game with fix the T50 and vary the D. You know, we're doing lots of things like this. And the only interesting thing in this plot is that that for very, very small spacing of the grating, there's still some response here. Whereas when the grating gets a little bit bigger, well, a lot bigger actually, there's no response. And it's due to this weird nonlinearity in the processing. So we're trying to, right now we want to know if this occurs, if this is real behaviorally or not, or if it's just some artifact of the way we're measuring things, or anesthesia state. So the only summary plot to put on this is just that, you know, when you say, well, okay, what's the probability of making an error in discriminating between two stimuli? If all I have is this cortical activity I'm observing under some assumptions, then as a function of this, of the grading size of this, then what happens is you would think it would be monotonically decreasing, because as the grading gets bigger and bigger, it seems like it would be easier to do, but there seems to be this maximum here at some other spacing. So what happens is here you actually do get some activity. You know, the sort of implicit thing here is that you do need cortical activity at some level to actually do this, to figure out what's going on, right? You can't have nothing. You can't have the cell not responding. So here the cell is not responding as much, and so you end up with doing things about by chance. You pick them between one and two. Anyway, so so how does this fit into the picture? And so if we think, well, there's an alert state where the animal is trying to transmit high-frequency information about what's going on with their whiskers, then what you'd want is you'd want this time course of suppression to be shorter. So faster recovery from suppression. But one thing I didn't mention is that it's a weaker response. So when it does respond, the cells don't respond as vigorously as compared to this case, where when the animal's either anesthetized or quiescent, there's the slower time course of recovery. So if you look here, this is, you know, relatively short, whereas this is long. So you have this long suppression following a response, but when it does respond, it responds a lot more vigorously. So it's, again, that signal-to-noise kind of problem is, well, I'm going to suppress most of things, and if you try to stimulate me repeatedly, I'm going to suppress that. But when I do respond to some kind of quick transient, I'm going to respond in a big way, because I want the next brain region hopefully to. And this is, you know, probably arising in the thalamus, so we're probably seeing it because of the thalamic projections doing this. So then the question is this detection? I put a question mark and a no. Versus discrimination. It's the same kind of framework. And it's not, you know, there's shades of gray in between. I don't want to draw a clear distinction between these two things, but I, you know, sitting here, you know, there are potentially two different ways, strategies with which you might want to convey the information. So the summary is just that the same circuitry may encode different features depending on behavioral task-related context. You know, modulated, how is it modulated? Mike brought up the fact that, you know, the burst versus the tonic firing could be self-regulated. Like, once it bursts, it goes into the tonic mode automatically. But how does it get to the burst mode? It might be that, you know, when the brain is in this sort of, you know, sleepy state, there are some neuromodulators that actually put it in that hyperpolarized state. And then the question is, how do we describe this from an information theoretic or optimization perspective? So I think that's more of a question. And then just to quickly, this is going to take just a minute. This is how we're going after this behaviorally. So we have these electrode arrays that we build in the lab. This is 25 independently positionable tetrodes. So it's 20 channels, or no, maybe it's 30. So it's 30. It's 30 tetrodes times four. So four channels per tetrode. So it's 120 channels. So it's a nightmare. But you can build these things so you can record from two brain regions simultaneously. So this one was actually built for a hippocampal study. So we, you know, stuck some in CA1 and stuck another chunk of electrodes in the entorhinal cortex. But we also are doing some stuff now where we're sticking it into S1 cortex for the whiskers along with the thalamus. And so we implant this in this guy, and, you know, I don't know how many people have seen these kind of things before, but the rat weighs about 300 grams, 250, 300 grams, and can live with something like 40 grams on his head, which is kind of amazing. They get used to this very quickly, and you know, this is a cone to protect it. But basically, it's this device, you know, with a connector on top, and then we put this cardboard cone around it because the rat will sort of bang into things and whatnot. But this is dental acrylic, so it's hard as a rock. So these are pretty robust. And then we have these guys running up and down mazes with textures on either side. And the trick is to get them to discriminate between different textures based on, you know, this kind of pass through the texture walls. And so here's just a picture of
Here's a picture of, let's see, can I stop here? Yeah, so here's a picture of the rat running through this maze. So there's a little chocolate Yoo-hoo dispenser things there that automatically dispense it. And they can actually really, you know, you can get them to do, you know, just hundreds of trials for this kind of thing. You food deprive them slightly to about 80% of the weight, and then you can get them to do this repeatedly. And so the textures are along the sides here. And what you're seeing flipping back and forth is, you know, my only physics graduate student really over-designed this, so he has these automatically sort of opening and closing gates and things to help train them. So, let's see, how do I get out of this thing? I guess it's this.
Okay. And they don't pause, so where's the texture?
So here's, so I made a big deal about whisking and all this stuff, and yet we chose an experimental paradigm where the guy just runs through it. And I think it was more historical than anything that we did the hippocampal study and we wanted rats to run the maze, and so that's what we did. Okay. We're struggling right now because in this case, and as you'll see, the rat runs through, but he's not whisking. So here, this shows the rat. This one doesn't have a time stick in front, the next one will, and you'll get a sense of the time course. But you can see this is great. You can see the whiskers, you know, coming in contact with the sides. This is actually kind of a hard thing to do. The lighting is very, very hard to get right. And I think David Kleinfeld will have some good examples of this kind of thing. But you can see the whiskers coming in contact with the different features there.
Is this a live rat?
Yeah. Oh yeah. Alive, awake, and presumably happy.
No, because it looks. It's not moving. I mean, presumably it walks, right?
It does look like a rat just.
Yeah. Oh no. What are you trying to say? So. No. The rat is alive. The rat is alive. This is a very high speed. This is very high speed video. Okay. This is a real pain in the butt.
It's like the rat
video. This is a real pain in the butt. You saw how fast the rat was going in the other video, right? That was normal speed. This one is. If you look at the time signature here, this rat is cruising, and so he's not physically moving, but he's going through this maze as fast as he can, and the whiskers are coming in contact with.
Does he get it right all the time? What is the?
Well, so here. Let me see. Okay, right. Okay, so that's where we are right now. In fact, so we're trying to get them to. We're being outsmarted by the rats. But so what we have done is we've implanted rats and run them down up and down this kind of this textured maze, and had them stop and eat at these textured areas here. And what we do see is that at least we know we're in the right brain region because the cortical activity goes up when the rat enters the textured region and comes back down when the rat leaves the textured region. So if you're playing some very simple game, you could say, well, tell me where they are in the maze. I could tell you whether they're here or here, roughly. Right now, what we're having trouble doing is getting them to actually discriminate between the textures. And it's because, and people who work with rats know this, that when you do a T-maze, they want to alternate. And they just want to alternate no matter what. They go left, right, left, right, left, right. And the idea is that they went to the left last time and they got some food. And so they said, well, I already got the food there, so I need to go over here instead. That's we don't know why the rats do this, but that's one possibility. So you have to employ all sorts of mechanisms to try to get them out of that behavior. So it's been difficult to get them to actually pay attention because they know, well, if I don't get the food this time, I go around next time and get the food. So that is a strategy, right? That they know that on average they're going to get some food, and so they don't have to work at it. So we've got to figure out a way to frustrate them a little bit more.
Can you punish them if they get it wrong?
Yeah. So we have things like, you know, you put them in an area and delay them so that they have to wait longer. You know, various people do various things to do that, but we're, you know, hopefully stay tuned on that one. So the folks that did all the work, Nick Leska did all the vision work. The data came, as I mentioned, I don't know if I mentioned this, but the thalamic data was collected in collaboration with Yang Dan, and I showed some retinal data for Marcus and Steve, and then Dan Butts was here, I guess. That's not a particularly attractive picture of him, but I didn't talk about it, but hopefully he talked about some of the things we're working on together. And then the somatosensory work was Roxana and Ali, and then Rob is the physics guy who's doing the behavioral thing, which is which hopefully will pan out soon. So I'll stop there.
So I didn't get the final thing. So in the end, in the teammates task, is the rat actually doing the discrimination
The rat is not currently doing it. We know they can.
Okay.
But we're not able to make them do that yet. They're not doing anything better than chance at the moment. But we think, you know, so here's what happened. We were under the impression that they could learn it in a couple of weeks. And that's just not true. And so the labs that are actually getting this to work are finding it takes 2 months of training. Every single day you spend, you know, an hour in the morning, an hour in the evening with the rat going through this thing, and after about 2 months they start to get it. So we had the wrong time scale, you know, and so I know that David's group is working on it, Dan Feldman's group at UCSD. There's a couple of other groups all sort of trying to get to this point, because we think this is a good model system for a lot of things. Plasticity, you can cut whiskers off and watch, you know, columns grow into each other. You can, you know, deprive, you can raise an animal in a natural environment and see there's some recent evidence that shows that the cortical structure changes dramatically. And you have a shot at the motor, you know, the motor piece of this, which with our paradigm is not for that, but you could imagine, and David will talk, I think he's got some recent work on detection tasks where there's a bar. The rat has to tell you where the bar is in this plane. And so there's, you know, it's here or here, and the rat is, you know, in a dark, you know, darkly lit environment, and the rat hits his whiskers on it and then indicates by either, you know, going to this food well or that food well, or pressing this bar, pressing that bar, whether it's there or not. So so the behavior is humbling, actually.
It's a little counterintuitive, right? Because rats move on visual tests a lot faster than that.
Yeah.
We were saying that rats probably use their whiskers are more importantly than their,
yeah,
their eyes, and yet they have a visual test.
Well, the confounding variable is that we're not, you know, we in our lab, we have no experience with the behavior. So I think that's the confounding. So maybe a behavioral psychologist could figure this out in 2 weeks. But, you know, for us, it's been a big challenge, actually.
Well, since you mentioned lemurs, that was the other question, is, you know, if it's really a teammates issue where they tend to go alternate, but maybe they don't do the same thing for lemur tasks.
Yeah, I think that's probably true.
Is that true?
Yeah, because they're not physically going one place
right,
or another.
Right.
So, and the other thing is, if you look back at the maze that we had designed here, well, it's better here, is that the food is way over here. And the problem is getting them to associate, you know, if they have to run all the way down this thing,
yeah,
and find out, oh, I don't get any food, what's wrong? They've forgotten by the time they got there about this. So there's this whole trick of trying to put the reward very close to the actual stimulus. There's the trick of trying to, you know, there's a lot of behavioral tricks that we're learning along the way.
So they remember that the food was there last time, which was a whole trial ago, but they forget.
Well, we don't know. It could be that they're leaving olfactory cues and they go, oh, I've been over there before, you know, let me go over this way. So there's some problems with this.
Can you change the texture from trial to trial?
Oh yeah, so these textures rotate. So we have this very highly instrumented maze. It's very cool, and we can do high speed videography, and we have LEDs mounted on the head, so we know exactly where the rat is. But the rat just has not cooperated yet.
But can't you do reward? I mean, you know, in dog training, you use clickers where,
yeah,
you know, as soon as it makes the right turn, and you give it a click.
Yeah. We're going to add an auditory cue and say, you know, yes, you got it right or not. And we're going to do some things to try to fix this. But I'm hoping that we can sort of get past this piece of it.
And you've tried, like, a timeout for a long time.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
It doesn't seem to
respond as well. Well, it doesn't seem to affect the behavior too much. But the thing we can do is we can get, you know, the good thing is we can get very clean single unit data from an array like this. And so, you know, at the moment, we don't know if they're using that information for the task or not. And so that's the hurdle we need to jump at the moment. So, of course, that's a dicey business, too, because you can never say, psychometrically, you know, the behavior sort of matches what you would think. Neurometrically,
is that a word, neurometrically? If those two things match, it doesn't mean that they're actually, you know, using it the way you think.
If they don't match, it's kind of, I think that's a path to go down that may not be great. But.
So in a number of active sensory systems, like the electrification of the bat, efferent copy appears very early on in the pathway, in the bat even in the sound pathway.
Yeah.
So is there, what's the evidence for efferent copy?
Yeah, it's,
system?
You know, it's, this is a kind of a, so no one really knows the answer to that yet. And there, it's not even clear
It's not even clear where, it's not even clear where the motor signals originate from. So that's one problem. And there is no current evidence that I know of a clear efferent copy. I have heard sort of anecdotal information from people at conferences, but I've never seen it published, where they say, yes, we're recording from S1, and we see sort of motor-related, information there, even in S1. So I don't know. I mean, the answer is I don't think this has been carefully done yet. And the interesting thing about this pathway is there are no, in the muscles, there are no muscle spindle in the muscles themselves. So it's relying completely on sensory, for comparisons, it's relying completely on sensory activity to provide this kind of control. So even if there is an efferent copy, you have to compare it with something. And it's not instrumenting the muscles themselves with sensors. It's actually relying on the soft tissue mechanoreceptors. So
do they whisk at theta frequency?
Yeah. They do whisk at about theta frequency. Yeah.
And does it phase lock with theta?
We don't know that. So David might talk about that a little bit. We've sunk electrodes in hippocampus, just sort of gross, sort of multi-unit kind of things to see, and we haven't seen it clearly. But I think he said at a conference last year that they were seeing some locking between the theta rhythms that you see, for instance, in hippocampus.
If they're sniffing at the same time,
yes,
it definitely locks to theta.
Yeah.
And so do you see theta rhythm and local field potential in S1?
We haven't looked at that carefully yet. So I would presume it would be there. Yeah.
But did you see the whisk at a fixed angular frequency or fixed speed? Is that correct? They don't change that very much.
Within a whisking bout.
Oh, within a bout, but from bout to bout, there's quite a bit of variation.
Right. Quite a bit, meaning 6 to 10 hertz.
I see.
You know, somewhere in there. But once it picks one, if it was like this, it's really narrow. So it's not clear where that gets set or how it gets set and why it gets set.
Okay. So
but it typically is around.
Slow and speeding up.
It's typically around 8 hertz though. But it doesn't typically slow down, speed up within a bout. So that's pretty. I think it's pretty robust data on that. So it's not exactly theta rhythm, but I think it's close enough to make you wonder. It's got to be right. It's got to be linked into olfactory. So they're sniffing at the same time. So I think some groups are starting to put sort of instrumentation in the nostrils to try to get sort of respiratory signals at the same time, because that'd be really neat to get. And you can also instrument the face with, you can surgically implant EMG electrodes into the muscles themselves. So you can get the muscle activity too. But all these things are kind of tricky. So. Thank you.